From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the Dearly Departed podcast. Here's what's happening. Oh, what a day in Washington, D.C. Unleashing unsealed fury about Democrats and the press. President Donald Trump railed against the investigation into his dealings with the Ukraine. Hours after House Democratic leaders warned the White House to expect a subpoena for documents, Democrats accused the administration of flagrant disregard of previous requests and said that refusal could be considered an impeachable offense. Now, separately, the Democrats accused Mr. Trump of an incitement to violence against the national security whistleblower and advised him and his administration not to intimidate potential witnesses in the impeachment inquiry. The whistleblower exposed a July phone call that President Trump had with the Ukrainian president in which Mr. Trump pressed for an investigation of Democratic political rival Joe Biden and his son. In appearances in the Oval Office and a joint press conference with the president of Finland, President Trump displayed an unusual show of anger as he defended what he called his perfect phone call with Zelensky, the Ukrainian president. He suggested without evidence that the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff may have committed treason, and again without evidence, labeled Biden and his son stone cold crooked. Bernie Sanders' campaign said that the Democratic presidential candidate had a heart procedure for a blocked artery and was canceling events and appearances until further notice. The 78-year-old Vermont senator was taken to a Las Vegas hospital after he experienced chest discomfort during a campaign event Tuesday and sought medical evaluation. Two stents were successfully inserted, and Sanders is conversing and in good spirits, according to the campaign. Howard Bloom, our expert on the global brain, with us right now. Howard, Sanders has just raised $25 million. Stents do help your arteries, but should he call it quits?
No, he shouldn't call it quits, but this is going to have a big impact on the campaign, and it's going to specifically boost Elizabeth Warren's chance in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Here are the details. On Tuesday, Bernie Sanders was in Las Vegas campaigning. He visited a memorial to the victims of the mass shooting of 2017, the one where 58 people died. Then Bernie went to a Persian restaurant called Shiraz to talk to an audience of 250. Normally, Bernie, as you know, is a fireball of passion. He is on his feet all the time. But Tuesday night, he did something unusual. He asked for a chair to sit in the middle of his talk. He was having chest pains. Sanders was taken to an unnamed Las Vegas hospital, as you said, was diagnosed with a blocked artery and had two stents inserted. Now, to see the political impact of Bernie's heart problem, let's look at a few facts. Way back in the presidential election of 2016, Bernie Sanders was the only clear articulator of a Democratic Party platform. He no longer holds that unique position because he laid down the planks that others would later pick up and run with, particularly free college education, medical care for all, and no campaign contributions from corporations or political action committees. Elizabeth Warren is the most successful of the candidates to pick up those planks and run with them. Before his heart incident, Bernie led the Democratic PAC in grassroots campaign contributions with a staggering 3.3 million donations, a sign of a grassroots support of a kind modern America has never seen. What's more, Bernie has brought in over $61.5 million in 2019. Now, that's nothing compared to Donald Trump and the Republican National Committee's reported haul of $125 million in just the third quarter of this year and a $300 million total for the year so far. But President Trump and the Republican National Committee are taking contributions from political action committees and corporations. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are not. In fact, Sanders and Warren are out to get the influence of corporations, billionaires, and lobbyists out of politics. What's more, Elizabeth Warren is looking more and more like Bernie's only serious challenger as the person who will offer an alternative to Joe Biden. Before Bernie's surgery, the New York Times said about Elizabeth Warren, she has surged in the polls to become Mr. Biden's leading rival. Then there's the age thing.
Yep.
Bernie is 78 years old, as you mentioned, and the heart stent surgery highlights that fact. Now, Paul Solomon, the economics and business correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, interviewed a 90-year-old economist a few years ago and tweeted that 90 is the new 60. The placement of stents for heart blockage is minor surgery. You walk in, you walk out the next day. 20 years ago, that would not have been true. And Ronald Reagan accustomed us to the idea of a president in his 70s in the Oval Office. But if Bernie Sanders wins, he would be 83 at the end of his first term and 87 at the end of his second. Then there's Joe Biden, who would be 85. Donald Trump, if he wins, would be 78 years old at the end of a hypothetical second term. Elizabeth Warren, on the other hand, is a mere 70 years old and has the energy of a nuclear reactor and the focus of a laser beam. So Bernie's heart problem could change the Democratic presidential campaign tremendously in Elizabeth Warren's favor, but he should not cut out of this race.
Let's watch what happens. Howard, thank you. A Connecticut state official says seven people have died in the crash of a World War II-era airplane. It was a era bomber B-17 during an aborted takeoff from Hartford's airport. The public safety commissioner says six others who were on the airplane suffered injuries ranging from minor to critical. No children on the plane. Three U.S. hospitals have been forced to temporarily close their doors to all but most critical new patients following a ransomware outbreak. They say a criminal is limiting our ability to use our computer systems in exchange for an as yet unknown payment of some kind. The hospitals affected are in Alabama. A man in Florida has been sneaking around his neighborhood tampering with electric scooters parked on the street. You probably have seen these where you live. They work via GPS and they're all over the place. Fort Lauderdale police posted a surveillance video showing a man walking up to an electrical scooter on the street, slapping a white sticker on its QR code and cutting its brake lines, especially rendering it impossible to use. Police say more than 140 scooters have been disabled and vandalized in a similar way near Fort Lauderdale. Officers had already honed in on the 59-year-old as a possible suspect, and the majority of the acts of vandalism happened within two blocks of his apartment. Stocks falling sharply on Wednesday, adding to Wall Street's poor start to the final quarter of 2019 as investors grapple with fears of an economic recession. The Dow Jones Industrial declined by almost 500 points. Let's check in with the expert of the consulting group IDP, Charles Kappes, author of America's Financial Reckoning Day. Well, is this the beginning? October's never good for the stock market anyways, Charles, is it?
You got that. October is always a bad month, about 25% more volatility. In fact, the fear index is up 29%, and that's the most since 1992. So something is really going on here to start the fourth quarter. This is the worst start since 2008, George. And it's related to trade and so on, but it's more related to weakness that we're not addressing. You know, this mm-hmm. lines up with what they call the Purchasing Managers Index. This is a 100-year-old monthly survey of 400 companies in 19 industrial sectors. This is an accurate survey on orders, sales, inventory, layoffs. And this PMI index has now dropped below 50. It's a metric from 1 to 100 and so on, but that's the biggest drop since 2009. So you can see that some are saying that that's an indication we're in a recession, and we can expect more. This is the real leading indicator of the economy, by the way. It's not Larry Kudlow or the tweets from the White House and so on. So I think we can expect more weakness, George, and we're advising our clients to lower their risk, get into cash, gold and silver, which is up 20%.
Yep.
Can't go wrong on that, I don't think.
Is there a loss of confidence out there too, Charles?
Yeah, that's the only thing holding up the markets, in fact, you know. And when that's eroded, boy, that really will head for the exit. So stocks are very overvalued to 1929 levels almost. Someone said when the tide goes out, we'll see who's been swimming naked. So there's going to be a lot of exposure.
Charles' book, America's Financial Reckoning Day, you can get it on Amazon and through his website, which is a part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Charles, thanks for that update. Bizarre deaths of bulls are baffling Oregon police and residents out that way. The first dead bull was found in a timbered ravine in eastern Oregon. There was no indication it had been shot. They don't know what's going on. It had not been attacked by predators or eaten anything poisonous. The animal's sex organs and tongue had been removed. All the blood was gone. Very strange story happening out that way. Up next, artificial intelligence. Cliff Pickover back with us on Coast to Coast. Wait till you hear this story. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our special guest for the next couple hours on this half, Cliff Pickover back with us. Artificial intelligence and illustrated history from medieval robots to neural networks. He's a prolific author, having published more than 50 books, translated into more than a dozen languages on topics ranging from science and mathematics to religion, art, and history. Received his doctorate degree from Yale University, has been granted more than 600 U.S. patents, and has more than 35,000 Twitter followers, and his patents are owned by a wide variety of companies. His website is pickover.com, has had millions of visitors joining him. His latest book that we've just mentioned, Artificial Intelligence and Illustrated History, from Medieval Robots to Neural Networks. Cliff, great job on the book, by the way.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
Looking forward to this. Give us your definition of artificial intelligence.
I think the simplest definition is basically apparently intelligent behavior in machines. So what do we consider intelligence in humans, right? It's problem solving, ability to complex goals, learning. So if we see these kinds of characteristics in machines or systems, we call that artificial intelligence. And it encompasses everything from self-driving cars to systems that look at medical x-rays to make diagnoses.
Is artificial intelligence a good thing for us?
I think it's a great thing. Artificial intelligence is a bit mysterious because even it can do marvelous things with diagnoses and look at patterns in the world. We don't always know how it's accomplishing its tasks, but I think it inspires us, will help us make safer cars, help doctors diagnose diseases. But there are always some concerns we can talk about. On the whole, I think it's very good.
I was going to say, it's got some downsides too, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would think that one of the concerns we might have is something called brittleness. In other words, AI can be very effective in looking at patterns, looking at pictures, looking at the x-rays, like we were mentioning.
Mm-hmm.
But they can be easily deceived by bad people, or they can make mistakes that humans would never make. So I call that brittle. They're great, but can be easily made defective. And that's one concern that scientists are working on and trying to improve that.
With artificial intelligence, why does it continue to get so intelligent? I mean, every year, Cliff, you can't pick up some kind of trade journal or see it in the media where something dramatic is happening with AI.
Yeah, I think every day there seems to be a news story on AI. A lot of the newsworthiness these days is because computers and other systems have become faster and faster and faster, and techniques have evolved also, so that only in the last few years have some of these miracle things happened with AI, and I think a lot of it's because of the speed of the computers.
Yeah, I think you're right, too. And those computers continue to get faster and faster and faster. You know, we've always had this argument that consciousness lives outside of the brain, and then some say, no, without the brain, there would be no consciousness. What do you think?
Yeah, if you think about it, in some sense, we are like consciousness or thinking or being running on hardware, but our hardware is the brain. It's the, you know, the wet organic thing in our skull. Now, if you think that thinking is really based on the patterns and interrelationships of brain cells in our brain, well, there's always the possibility that you could do thinking in other kinds of hardware, you know, electronic hardware, for example. Some people even would say that if the pattern is important, the brain or the mind could be instantiated in moving twigs or the flocking of birds,
mm-hmm.
or even bicycle parts. But of course, to build a brain that could think from bicycle parts, it would have to be huge to get to the complexity of a human brain.
Cliff, what do you think of the possibilities that we're really not here? We're living in some kind of computer animation, some matrix.
Yeah, if we could create artificial intelligence someday that is thinking and conscious, right? We've already simulated very complex behaviors mathematically. We're exploring virtual reality. So if civilizations exist in the galaxy or in the universe that are doing some kinds of simulations, the idea is that perhaps we could live in a simulation. Of course, that's the stuff of movies, right? But people, scientists
right.
actually take that seriously and are considering that idea that simulations are possible and that we could be in one.
I hope they don't erase the program.
Yes. Some have said, if we discover we're in the simulation, maybe that's too bad for humanity. They'll just turn us off.
But if we were simulated, I mean, why do we feel and, we hurt, we laugh? We do have these feelings. I mean, is that something that could have been created artificially and we're just tricked to think this is happening to us?
Right. Well, we're already establishing some kind of thinking in AI, even though it's maybe on a simple level. We're probably not at the level of consciousness, certainly not human consciousness, which has to do more with feeling things, like you're saying. But who knows, 10, 100, 200 years, right, we'll have probably uncovered so much with simulations, the brain and AI, that these things will be conscious. And then once you have that idea, if you can make a conscious AI, you could make it in a simulated world rather than our real world to study it and learn from it. So that's one of the ideas floating around.
How dramatic can artificial intelligence get where robotics and things like that are just really beyond what anybody could imagine?
Well, there's one idea called the superintelligence explosion, where we make very good AIs, and then the AIs begin to make better AIs. And it gets faster and more intelligent, until something called the singularity is approached, where we could barely comprehend what's going on. Now, scientists argue quite a bit if this will really happen or when it will happen, but there's no doubt, like we started with at the show, that the AIs are getting smarter. They're getting more capabilities. We're relying on them, and we're giving them more and more of our decision-making. And so that's what the superintelligence explosion is. And that's what people are cautious about.
Now, with artificial intelligence, as it continues to get smarter and smarter and smarter, it still lacks one thing that I believe all humans have, and that is a soul. How do we compensate for that?
Yeah, in fact, in the book, I have a section called Searches for the Soul. And this kind of concept has gone back to ancient days, time of Descartes. He said the brain and the soul, well, they're two totally different things, and they might be connected with in a piece of the brain called the pineal gland, right? But today, as we're saying, many scientists say, well, perhaps this can be run on on hardware that's not the brain. One of the great scientists, Alan Turing, said that, even if we could create AI, God wouldn't think that we're taking away from his or her power. The AI is just a mansion for the soul or a home for the soul, just like human beings are homes for the soul. So scientists and philosophers do touch on these topics. And so while in the book, I talk about some hardcore technology, I also get into these philosophical issues.
What got you interested in investigating AI, Cliff?
Well, I think I've always been interested in the borderlands of science and science fiction. And AI sort of makes us question, what are the limits of thought? And what's the humanity's future? What can be more interesting than that? I think that combination of factors got me into AI.
Part of the title has to do with medieval robots. What did they have in those days?
Yeah, most of we think of AI. That sounds like today, the future, robots, computers.
Right.
Right? But, ancient legends go back to ancient Greece of big bronze robots circling the island of Crete. Of course, that's just a legend, but it shows the fascination of humanity with the line between the living and the non-living. Then you get up to the Middle Ages, and they were making all sorts of clockwork automata that resembled living things, that resembled humans, resembled animals. If there's time, we could talk about some of them, but there are all kinds of robotic-like things that existed in the Middle Ages. Of course, they're not as sophisticated today, but they were quite ingenious for the time.
I mean, most of them worked with pulleys and ropes and things like that, I would guess.
Yes, pulleys, clockwork, some were driven by water, so you have a stream of water that would make them move in lifelike ways. One of the wildest ones, make your audience laugh a little, is this one called the Defancanson duck.
Hold on, and we'll talk about the duck when we come back in a moment. Cliff Pickover with us. His latest book is called Artificial Intelligence. His website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll take calls with Cliff Pickover next hour here on Coast to Coast. We're talking about his latest work, Artificial Intelligence. Can't believe Halloween is right around the corner. And, of course, that night will be our annual Ghost to Ghost show, and you get to participate, Tommy.
It is coming up, Ghost to Ghost, Thursday, October 31st, and we are looking for your ghost stories. Send us your scariest stories. We're going to pick a few, and you could tell them live on the air that night. Email your name, phone number, and your best and scariest ghost story to ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com. That's ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com.
And we get lots of emails, so send them as soon as you can. We'll be back with more with Cliff Pickover on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Cliff Pickover with us. George Norrie here, Artificial Intelligence, his latest book. Cliff, we were talking about this robotic duck from how long back?
Yes, this is from 1738. And it's an example of these ingenious mechanisms that even in more ancient times, humans were experimenting with.
What did they make? How did this work?
Yeah, this one has a humorous part I thought your audience would like. This was made by a French watchmaker and had hundreds of moving parts. It would look like a duck. It moved its head. It played with water with its bill. It flapped its wings. It quacked. And it even gulped food. But the humorous part is that After you fed it, you waited a while, and it would. The remains of the digested food were eliminated. So this is a famous mechanical duck. You might say, well, is that AI? Well, maybe not, but it's on humanity's road to looking at mechanical creatures and beings that made people of all ages of history interested in that line between living and non-living.
Was it a toy? Did he sell this thing?
No, it was too complicated to be a toy for back then, but it went on shows, and all sorts of visiting dignitaries would come and look at it, wonder how it worked. This same French watchmaker, he made other things where, I remember one was a flute player, a human flute player. He made weaving machines, and some of the townspeople didn't like that because they thought it could take jobs. But it was very complicated for the time, and the idea was it looked so realistic or acted so realistic that it made people really take note and wonder.
Was this watchmaker way ahead of his time, Cliff?
Yeah, he was way ahead of his time. And imagine the tenacity. I mean, today we have all these sorts of machines to help us build things and to make the gears and make everything else. Back then, it was a little bit, a lot more difficult to make these finely made parts.
One of the concerns about artificial intelligence is that it could get out of control. How can it get out of control? I mean, what are the possibilities?
Well, this gets into that topic of superintelligence we touched on a little bit, where if you can make an AI that's sufficiently advanced, you may enlist it to make even more advanced AIs to the point where they're recursively making themselves in ways we can barely comprehend. And then they become super intelligent. One of the ideas I talk about in the box is that, in the book, is that scientists wonder, could you box such a creature off and study it, study it safely? And they call that a leak-proof AI box. And that would be very difficult to do because you'd have, even if you could isolate it from the internet, right? You don't have to connect it to the internet, but you'd have human gatekeepers. And if the thing was that smart, it could conceivably bribe the gatekeepers, you know, we'll give you certain cures for diseases and you'll listen to all these beautiful melodies. Just let us escape onto the internet. So it's a fascinating speculative topic about could you actually box these things up without letting them escape?
And some AI right now has the capability of predicting when you may die.
Yeah, that's what an example in the book where I want to give readers an idea of very unusual applications of AI. This is the AI death predictor. They've been researched very recently. And the idea is they've tried these out on patients in hospitals and other people. And these death predictors could predict very accurately if someone would die in 3 to 12 months.
Wow.
And that might seem a little gruesome, you know, a little scary, but you could see it could possibly reduce suffering because it lets doctors and families and caregivers prepare and think about what the best types of treatment would be. But would you want to know, right? Well, I don't think I'd want to know if an AI could tell me, you know, Cliff, next month you're going
to
kick.
Well, I'd want to know, Cliff, if I could make changes to change the outcome.
That's a very good point. If you could prepare, change some aspect of your life, if you could change the outcome, sure, that would be very.
Because, you know, the AI would be based on the way you're living, your lifestyle, how you eat, everything else. And if it said you've got a year to live based on your lifestyle, boy, you're going to change that. And maybe you could prolong it 5, 10, 15 years.
No, that's a good point. And they're getting better and better, these AIs, at ingesting medical records or looking at X-ray scans and determining a lot about your future. And you're right. If you could make these changes, you would like to be able to prepare to try to make those changes.
I would love an AI machine that would have the psychic ability to predict the future based on certain things. Now, that would be intriguing, too.
Yes. Well, in medicine, we're almost there. They can look at certain scans and predict Alzheimer's. That's a little bit, makes us a little nervous. But these AIs are almost like divination machines. You know, in the ancient days, the ancient diviners of Rome and other societies, they'd look at animal organs and predict the future. Well, AIs can do miraculous things that we can't understand. For example, one of the best examples is they can look at the back of your eye, the blood vessel patterns on the retina,
mm-hmm.
and they can make predictions like, are you a man or a woman? Many things of that nature. And there's no way a human doctor can look at the back of your eye and tell if you're a man or a woman. So how does the AI even do that?
Of course, why do we have to look at the back of the eye to make up that?
That's true, but it's just showing you.
I could beat an AI machine a little faster than looking behind the eyeball, that's for sure.
Yeah, most of the time, yes. But it shows you they're looking at some patterns that humans don't understand, and maybe it will inspire us to try to learn. How does it do it?
What is called the Moravec's paradox? What is that?
Moravec's paradox is interesting in that it says what's hard is simple and what's simple is hard with AI. Let me give an example. Difficult tasks with high-level reasoning, like playing expert chess. Well, now that's very easy for the computers, but that's pretty hard for humans. And tasks that are easy for us, like we can pick up lint from the floor, mm-hmm. tie our shoes, or walk in different terrain. That's easy for humans. So that's Moravec's paradox. It shows you that AI and people are very different in what's hard and what's easy for them, almost opposites.
Can AI become, in your opinion, too powerful?
Well, I think one of the challenges is that we're turning more decisions over to the AIs, and we have to, we have to be careful about that because they can be easily fooled. And we will also probably lose some of our own skills. Already we use GPS devices.
Sure.
Right? And now we probably are not as good at reading maps or sense of direction. So that, in a way, is becoming powerful. And they're also going to change our notion of what's real. That could be a concern.
Would you say that a early day calculator, electric battery operated calculator, was, you know, artificial intelligence?
I think that's on the road to artificial intelligence, because anything that helps offload our cognitions and helps us do thinking, intelligent kinds of tasks, that's a simple step on the road. I mean, you can even go back further to devices like the abacus, right, with these moving beads. That help humans do computations. So I think it is a tool on the step to more advanced AI, and every year they become more and more advanced.
Part of the downside of that, Cliff, is you take someone who is a younger aged person and give them a couple mathematical formulas and say subtract 1921 from 78, what do you get? I'm not sure they can do it out of their head.
Right. I'm getting the same way. In school, we were taught all sorts of ways of doing simple math. I think I remember even being taught how to take the square root of 2. But now, who knows how to do that, right? You just hit the calculator button.
And do it.
Yeah, it does it for you.
I mean, it's intriguing. What is, We've heard a lot of it, transhumanism. What is it to you?
Transhumanism is an interesting topic that I discuss. It actually was coined back in the 1950s by Julian Huxley. But today we basically say transhumanism is using technology to enhance the mental and physical capabilities of humans. And some people say that soon we're going to understand the biological basis of aging, and if we can do that, we might become immortal. You know, whether that's good or bad, we can discuss, but that's certainly, I think, going to happen in this century.
Will we live longer because of AI?
Yes, I think we definitely will, because it's helping physicians in so many ways. Already, you can look at a chest x-ray and detect pneumonia in the lungs just as good as, or even better, than a trained radiologist. It's good at, also, it can look at heart wave patterns. It can find things that we have trouble finding, and therefore provide sort of an early warning system to help humans, and that'll help us live longer. It'll also help us make safer cars and increase safety, many, many areas it'll help us in.
Some doctors are doing surgery via robotics through the internet. They're not even there.
Yes, that's
amazing.
Telesurgery. Some people have even tried to do it with wireless stations on drones. They're even investigating surgeons that are completely divorced from human altogether, where it can stitch up an intestine very accurately, more so than a human. But today, mostly the robots doing surgery are humans using laparoscopic keyhole surgery. But you're right, the robots, the computers can suppress tremors, and they can do it from one state to another, or even one country to another, over a very fast communication channel.
Cliff, I'm not sure I'd want a robot with a scalpel coming my way.
Yeah, it is a little nerve-wracking, but hey, we care about outcomes. And if you were told that is better than a human, you might think about it.
A lot of people believe in the existence of God. Do you think artificial intelligence enhances that or kind of takes it away?
Well, I think because AI gives us this mysterious insight, like we were talking about, looking at patterns in the world, and the AI will inspire us in ways, and it'll help us reason beyond our own intuition. Right now, right, a monkey brain and a human brain, they're not all that much different, but a monkey can't understand calculus and logic and poetry and doesn't know about black holes. And so I would imagine that there are concepts we can never think, and that is leading us on the way to AI to maybe help us dream new dreams and think new thoughts.
Can AI become unethical?
That's a big area of study today, ethics. You say, well, what does that have to do with AI? But I think a simple example is a self-driving car that has some AI in it, so it can have some intelligence. What if a collision is imminent? Should the car protect the passenger, or should it protect the pedestrian who's about to be hit? That's an ethical decision that a car would have to make, presumably at some point. There's ethics involved in lethal weapons. Do you want a drone to be able to pick a target, lock on it, and destroy? Or do you want a human in the loop? These are all ethics. Do you want a judge that's an AI or a human? Right? All ethical problems that we have to think about with AI.
What about one day, and this will happen, you'll have an army of 1,000 soldiers all armed with weaponry, but there'll be robotics, all of them.
Yes. We're already enhancing human soldiers in different ways. Already drones have vision systems that can select targets. And the question is, when do you let that become autonomous and make its own decision? Or when do you say, even to the robot soldier, you can't do a kill without a human saying, okay? You know, that is a question. In a sense, what if the drone could be more accurate and have less casualties than a human? It makes you think of what's right and what's wrong.
Our special guest tonight, Cliff Pickover, his book, Artificial Intelligence. And we will take calls with Cliff right at the latter part of the beginning of next hour, of course, right after the news breaks from your local stations. Cliff, since you've been looking at artificial intelligence, what country might have the step up on other countries?
You usually hear that it's a race between America and China. China has invested very heavily in AI research and they have great talent there. But of course, AI is being investigated all over the world, and you know what we call AI keeps evolving. Right? Talking to your Amazon Echo, right, and it answers back. We hardly call that AI, but that would be like a miracle decades ago. So what we call AI is basically what we can't do today, but when we do it, we say, well, that's not AI. I think China and America are very in the race.
Had a story yesterday where workers were attacking robots that were working in their plant and factories with them because they felt that they were taking jobs away from them, so they started beating them with clubs.
That is a big concern. The nature of jobs is certainly going to change in the coming years with AI. I mean, if you look at a picture of New York City from 1900, on Fifth Avenue, there's nothing but horses. And then by 1913, there's nothing but cars. So you can see in a short span of time, jobs and technology can change very rapidly. What I think will happen is that jobs where people work with AI will replace jobs where there's no AI at all, because the AIs will be tools for workers in many, many fields.
I think most people, Cliff, got their exposure to robotics with Star Wars, with C-3PO and R2-D2. What do you think?
Yes, and if you go back further, you remember 2001, they had HAL 9000.
Oh, yeah. Space Odyssey.
But HAL, you know, got into a lot of mischief. That was scary. There's a number of movies, right? Terminator, where Terminator takes over. So that's a theme going back even into the 1930s. There's 1927, there's Metropolis, a silent film with robots. So it's very, very much on humans' minds.
Didn't HAL the robot kill off people?
Yeah, he started killing people, and then he had to be deactivated by a human. That was the film by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke.
Space Odyssey, right?
Yes, exactly. And that was a computer that could do many, many things. They call that artificial general intelligence, right? It could play chess. It could speak. It seemed to even have some kind of emotionality. And I think a lot of scientists even today got stimulated from science fiction movies. They saw these robots, good or evil, and said, that's very interesting. I'm going to do some, maybe I can do some research in that.
Cliff, what's the favorite part of artificial intelligence for you? What do you really like about it?
Well, I think it's the idea that it's helping humanity and lets us think new thoughts. And one of the most surprising things about the book is how there actually is this ancient history going back to ancient times where humans were always thinking about artificial beings and artificial life. And today the applications are just so limitless. We have AI on Mars in a rover that's going around Mars and looking at rock specimens.
Far exceeding what they thought would happen.
Exactly. So I think that the fact that it's playing so many different roles and can even be creative in many ways, that of course, it makes us a little nervous, right? Because it's something so new and so powerful.
Sure.
But I think that makes it interesting and requires all of us to think about it. Philosophers, scientists, everything. You know, what can we do to make sure that the transition to AI is done in a way that is humane and helps society and doesn't lead to too many problems?
What don't you like about AI?
Well, I think it's the fact that AI can be so easily tricked. There's one example called adversarial patches where you could train an AI to say, this is a banana. You put a banana in front of it and the vision says a banana. You put a little psychedelic patch next to it, suddenly it says it's a toaster. Now, that's a funny example of how easily it can be deceived. But imagine a self-driving car that looks at a stop sign and someone put a little pattern on it and says it's a speed limit, right? I think the fact that they can be tricked either just through noise or through ill intention, it makes you a little nervous.
Oh, don't get me started about these driverless vehicles. I mean, I'm so opposed to them, especially trucks, for two reasons. One, I don't want our truck drivers losing jobs. I also think it's dangerous. We'll talk more about this, Cliff. We'll take phone calls next hour. And I'm going to ask everybody who calls a quick question in addition to your question, and that will be, would you like to know through artificial intelligence when you're going to die?